You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about what happens behind the scenes when animals go into hibernation for the winter.
First, President-elect Trump talked a lot about boosting the American economy on the campaign trail. While he hasn't released all the specifics on how he'll try to do that just yet, the president-elect has some details of his tax plan and has talked about the future of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Our next guest recently wrote about what Trump's win could mean for the average American's finances and looked at everything from housing to health care. Janelle Marte is financial reporter for The Washington Post. Janelle, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, what are some of the earliest effects that Donald Trump's economic policy could have on consumers?
So, of course, he talked a lot about lowering taxes, and this is something that he may try to bring through, especially as he begins to work more closely with the Republicans in control of Congress. And according to his early proposals, this would pretty much mean tax cuts for people at all income levels, but especially for people at the top. So, for example, according to the Tax Policy Center, they estimated that for the top earners, the top 0.1% of earners, that it would essentially equate to a 14% boost in their after-tax pay. But again, the big theme there being that if he has his way, we could see a simpler tax code, fewer tax rates, and lower taxes for many consumers.
And Donald Trump has also pledged to give the middle-class earners a break when it comes to taxes. How would middle-income couples, for instance, fare under his tax plan as we know it so far?
Yeah, so according to the Tax Policy Center again, they said that for the average consumer, their tax bill would be cut by about $3,000 next year, boosting their pay by roughly 4%.
And it sounds like there are some people who might not benefit quite as much, single parents, for instance. What happens there?
Right. So, again, in his early proposals, he did call for adjusting some of the credits that parents can take for their children, or even getting rid of the head of household filing status, which really tends to benefit single parents. But you have to keep in mind that in order to pass this kind of comprehensive tax reform, he will have to work with Congress. And there are some people who may say, hey, well, we need to balance this off a little bit to minimize essentially the government borrowing or what this could do to the government deficit. So, again, we don't know how much of this will go through. But you're right in that in the early versions, it might not be so good for single parents.
So to be clear, this does have to go through Congress. Anything could change, but it sounds like he has planned to eliminate the head of household option on taxes and also letting people write their children as dependents. So I guess that would change across the board, single parents or no.
True, yeah.
The last two, right. So looking at growth, now Donald Trump has said that this tax plan would engender growth and that the growth in the economy would lift all ships, make the financial outlook rosier for people. How might that work?
So I think one of the things that we saw that were actually surprised some people the day after the election results came in was that the markets rallied and they actually reached new highs over the next couple of days. So what that shows is that some people in the investing world are starting to think, hey, Donald Trump, if he has the support of the Republicans in Congress, he can actually pass laws, pass legislation, and maybe some of the infrastructure spending that he has been that he talked about during his campaign may become a reality. So think about it, more infrastructure spending that could lead to more jobs and that could, you know, overall help out the economy. A lot of these tax breaks that he's proposing, that's more money in consumers' pockets as well. However, that would have to be balanced with the fact that this could also mean more government spending. So what's going to change to make that a reality? We don't know yet. And so it's not clear what the final effects could be. But at least on these two fronts, it could be good for the economy in the near term.
Janelle Marte is with us right now. She's a reporter at The Washington Post covering personal finance, and she's with us now to talk about how President-elect Donald Trump's plans might affect your personal finances. And let's move to the Affordable Care Act. This is something that Republicans have been looking to roll back for quite a while now, and they'll have control of both chambers of Congress in addition to the office of the president. So what kinds of revisions do you think Americans could think about expecting to that health care law?
So this is one area where the day after, or just a few days after Trump won the election, we started to see him softening some of his language on how he would adjust the law. For instance, now he's saying that perhaps he would allow people to stay on their parents' plans until age 26, which is a very big part of the Affordable Care Act. He even said he might allow keep the ban on not the ban, but now under the law, insurance companies can't reject you if you have a pre-existing condition. He's now supporting that. But, it's unclear. We'll start to see more details as he works with Republicans, because they have said that this is a top thing on their list, that they want to either get rid of the Affordable Care Act or adjust it, scale back different components of it. And I think that we'll start to see him maybe softening some of his ideas to work more with what Republicans are in support of.
Do we know anything about the requirement for people to have insurance?
So I know in early versions he has said that he doesn't want, that under his version, he wouldn't require individuals to have insurance. So whether he'll have that support, or whether the Republicans in Congress will support that, I think it's not clear yet. They're sort of slowly adding more details to the transition website, and we'll know more as he continues to talk about this.
Looking at the market itself, we saw some fluctuations, especially during that last week of the race, but do we have an idea what we can expect from the market in the coming weeks, in the coming months?
So I think that more than anything, the election has shown that markets are truly unpredictable. Even though people thought they knew what to expect, like I said, on Wednesday morning, the day after the election, many of us were surprised. Everyone I talked to on Wall Street was surprised. They kind of thought that this would be viewed as a vote for uncertainty, that banks would, and investors would want to know more about what it is that Trump wants to accomplish. But actually, after he gave his acceptance speech, and so far he's sort of toned down a lot of what he said he would do. And I think the message now is like, hey, we might actually have someone in the White House who is pro-business. Here's a real estate developer. He has never had elected office, so maybe that's good for the economy, at least in the short term, especially some of the things we've been talking about, the tax cuts, the higher infrastructure spending. That could boost economic growth in the short run. But, we've also seen that people are selling bonds, and that's sort of raising rates on those bonds and lowering the prices. So it's sort of unclear how this will all shake out in the end. But, in the near term, at least, it's looking like higher interest rates and better tax, better returns in the market in the near term.
Janelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That was Janelle Marte. She's a reporter at The Washington Post covering personal finance, and she was with us there talking about how President-elect Donald Trump might affect your personal finances. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about what happens to Wisconsin animals that hibernate in the wintertime.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Ron Weber first drove deer out of the woods as a teenager with his brothers. His brothers have since passed away, but Weber is still driving deer.
I first made the drive at 17 with my older brothers, Gary and Jim. We'd seen few deer and were in danger of going home with no venison. The drive required Jim and I to push through a half mile of alder and Cedar Creek bottom towards Gary on the edge of the hardwoods. I'd never been in these woods, but I felt safe knowing Jim was beside me and Gary was waiting on the other side. Moving through the woods, I started to doubt myself. Just as panic was setting in, a shot rang out in front of me. Further ahead, I saw orange off to my right. Jim said it must have been Gary who shot. As we gathered around the deer, I was happy that after an exhausting season of dawn-to-dusk hunting, we had at least this deer to show for it. It was a small success, but a success. Over the next 30 years, we continued to make the Crick Drive. As deer numbers grew, this drive became one of our favorites. Arriving at camp in 2011, I wasn't greeted by Jim sitting with the others at the table. As we talked on the phone through the fall, he said he had a stubborn virus. One coughing spell from the couch told me it was no virus. Instantly, I knew the bill had come due on 40 years of smoking. Jim didn't make it out the entire week. On Saturday, I knew I had to get him out one more time. As I finished the drive and came up on Jim, he struggled to stand. Walking behind him, it broke my heart to realize the hard-charging hunting hero I had known all my life was gone. He passed away just after Christmas, 2012. In 2013, a tornado reduced the Crick area to a twisted mass of downed trees. Nature was reminding me that change is inevitable, and death is a very necessary part of life. I figured I'd never make the Crick Drive again. I was wrong. That fall, I got news that Gary, also a smoker, had been diagnosed with an inoperable tumor on one of the major arteries in his lungs. Gary came to deer camp as always, but had to go back on Monday for a treatment. He wasn't able to hunt opening day, and Sunday was his last day. I came back to camp around noon and talked Gary into going with me to make a drive. I had to. We went to the Crick. Gary stood in the same spot Jim had 2 years earlier. I made my way through the twisted trees. Nothing looked the same. There were times I wasn't sure where I was going, but I felt Jim by my side. It would be nice to say that Gary got his buck, but he didn't. Fairy tales don't happen very often. 2 weeks later, his artery ruptured. My other hunting hero had left me too soon. With the heart and soul gone, others stopped coming for the annual pilgrimage to the cabin on Lake Namekagon. I hunt the big woods by myself now, but I'm never alone. There is too much history, too many memories for that to be. I've never smoked and enjoy good health, so God willing, I have many more hunts left. I still have the drive to finish. Like that long ago November day, I'm sometimes scared and not sure where I'm headed. But I feel safe knowing that Jim is always beside me, and Gary is waiting on the other side.
Ron Weber is a forester in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Winter is coming, and with the cold winter weather on its way, who doesn't love the thought of maybe hunkering down a bit, hibernating until the warmer temperatures return?
Well, our next guest tells us exactly what happens when animals do just that. Here to talk about animal hibernation is David Drake, a professor and extension wildlife specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
Well, spell out the basic strategies. Animals got to get through winter one way or another. What are their options?
Yep. So there's three main options for a species of wildlife. And we're talking about the northern climates where you have a seasonal shift in temperature and daylight and things like that. And so just think about Wisconsin, for example, in that type of a climate. So animals have three general ideas in mind. So one, they can just hightail the heck out of here and go south. So those are the animals that migrate, and primarily those are bird species that migrate going south.
And although, retirees.
Yeah, I was going to say, we do have snowbirds too, right? The retirees that are heading south as well. So that's one option. One option is to go into some form of torpor. And a torpor is just defined as some kind of a controlled reduction in body temperature and metabolism. So you're actually going into some kind of a deep sleep, or the most extreme form of torpor is hibernation that we just heard about. And then the other option is that you don't go anywhere and you don't go into any form of torpor, but you are active year-round, and you're active and you stay in this climate through the winter. And so there's some strategies then that these animals have to employ if they're going to be active year-round, especially through the winter, because that typically is the most difficult time of the year on them, because they food sources are reduced, and obviously you have that cold weather, so they've got to combat that.
Let's key in on the hibernators now. So you gave us some of a almost technical definition of hibernation, but what's involved? What makes one thing hibernation, one thing just kind of going underground for a bit?
Yeah, so generally what drives all of this, whether the animals are going to migrate or they're going to hibernate or go into some form of torpor again, is the day length. And so the length of sunlight that we have, obviously, the shorter the days, the colder the temperatures, we have a different type of precipitation. So instead of rain, we might have snow and things like that. So the length of day is actually the large driver that tells animals, if you're going to head south, you better get going pretty soon, or if you're going to go into hibernation, you better get prepared for that. And so if animals are going to hibernate or go into some form of torpor, and there's variations of torpor. So some animals will go into a type of torpor where they'll reduce their body temperature, for example, at night when they sleep, and then they'll raise the body temperature back to a more active level during the day, for example. And so that's a variation of torpor. Again, the most extreme variation of torpor is hibernation, where the animal, like a bat, for example, or a groundhog, or also called a woodchuck, that they'll go into hibernation maybe, you know, end of October, sometime in November, and then they'll just stay in hibernation through the entire winter until they come out of hibernation again sometime in the spring. And so what happens for all these animals is that they've got to prepare by putting on some kind of fuel or extra calories. And so typically that's in the form of what's called brown fat. And brown fat is there's different types of fats, but brown fat is a fat that it burns easily, and it's one of the types of fat that these animals use to wake up. And so the benefit is that if you're going to go into torpor, you are actually reducing your body temperature so that your body temperature is just a few degrees above the ambient or air temperature. So if you're a species of wildlife and you can reduce your body temperature closer to the actual ambient temperature, there's not this large gradient, and you don't have to spend as much energy to do so. So when they're in hibernation, they reduce their respiration, they reduce their heart rate, they reduce their metabolism, and by doing that, it allows them to save energy. So they'll pack on as much energy as they can prior to hibernation, and then they'll live off that fat or off that energy all winter long until it's time to wake back up. The animals that go into torpor, where they just lower their body temperature on a daily basis or a nightly basis, for example, then every time that they raise their body temperature, it costs them a lot of energy to do so. So they've got to really find a lot of food and replace that energy almost daily. Whereas, you know, a seasonal hibernator, they only have to survive through the winter, and they only have to use that very expensive energy once to wake back up in the spring.
Talking to wildlife specialist David Drake about hibernation and how Wisconsin wildlife makes it through the winter. So you kind of answered one thing for me there. I wonder sometimes, oh, wow, we had this really warm November, December. Mm-hmm. Does that throw anybody off? They don't know it's time to hibernate. You're saying no, it's the length of the day.
It's primarily the length of the day. Now, so what will happen, however, and I should also say there's other strategies going on here. So if you're a hibernator, for example, a lot of times you're hibernating in some kind of a sheltered area. So either you're under the ground, or if you're black bears are not, there's still some controversy out there, but they're most likely not true hibernators because they do wake up, or they're able to be woken up over the course of their hibernatory period. But for example, a bat, you know, bats go into a lot of times caves, and those caves are high humidity, and they stay a pretty constant temperature at 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's relatively warm in there. So they pick these microclimates where it also helps them not have to burn as much energy as if they were out in the wide open and this cold winter wind was blowing across them all the time.
So you've mentioned a few of the hibernators. Can you name some more names? Who among our neighbors out there is hibernating right
now?
Yep,
so typically it's smaller bodied animals, because the smaller your body, the quicker you lose heat. This this ratio between the amount of surface area that your skin is covering your body compared to the amount of heat generating tissue. So your organs are constantly, as they're beating, they're also generating heat. But because you don't have a lot of skin around that, you lose that heat very quickly. So the smaller animals typically have some kind of a torpor strategy. So the jumping mice, we have a woodland and a field metal jumping mice. So they hibernate bats hibernate, ground squirrels, woodchucks, things like that will typically hibernate.
I see a lot of rabbits. They like to munch on tree bark. Yep. I don't know, in my backyard. Yep. Only the ones I've paid money for. They're big enough they don't have to hibernate, or do they do that partial torpor you were talking about?
Well, no. So rabbits, they also, animals that are going to be active year-round, for example. So you think about otter or mink or something like that. These animals are what we call fur bearer species. Well, they put on their coat becomes prime and it becomes very, very thick in the winter. So that if you're a trapper, that's why you trap in the wintertime, is because the coat is prime.
Oh.
So those animals have an extra thick coat. In the winter, it would be too thick for them. In the summer, they would overheat. Mm-hmm. And so rabbits put on a nice, they've got a nice thick coat, but they also eat a lot of food, and they have a relatively high metabolism that keeps that internal engine constantly churning. But they also have to feed that engine all the time, and so that's why they're eating your very expensive bark.
So I want to end with the bears. I have grown up assuming that bears hibernate. You say that's a controversy.
Well, they go into torpor. And the reason some people don't think they're true hibernators like a bat. So a bat will go into hibernation, and they don't wake up until the springtime. Well, bears, the female bear, if she's pregnant, she'll give birth in the middle of the winter. And they can be awoken if you go in and disturb them in their hibernatory den or wherever they might be. So they don't hibernate through the entire season like a true hibernator, like a groundhog or a bat would.
All right, that's all we have time for. David, thanks a lot for joining us. Really interesting.
Thank you.
David Drake is a professor and extension wildlife specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We've been learning about animal hibernation here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, America's religious landscape is changing. According to a new report from the Pew Research Center, 20% of Americans grew up in households with more than one religion represented. We talk to the researcher behind this report next. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Reveal. On tonight's edition, a look back at lessons learned from this year's chaotic election season. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, the religious landscape in America is changing across the country and within families, as illustrated in this clip from the early 2000s show, The O.C.
We didn't really know how to raise Seth.
Yeah, so I raised myself. And in doing so, I created the greatest super holiday known to mankind, drawing on the best that Christianity and Judaism have to offer.
And you call it Chrismica.
Just hearing you say it makes me feel all festive. Allow me to elaborate. You see, for my father here, a poor struggling Jew growing up in the Bronx, well, Christmas, it meant Chinese food in a movie. And for my mom over here, well, it meant a tree, it meant stockings and all the trimmings. Isn't that right?
We're very proud.
Other highlights include 8 days of presents, followed by one day of many presents. So, what do you think?
That was a clip from the 2000s television show The O.C. describing the traditions of one household with a Jewish parent and a Protestant parent.
A survey of the religious landscapes of the country done by the Pew Research Center found that about 20% of Americans grew up in households with more than one religion represented. Of these Americans, about 1 in 10 said they were raised by two people of differing religious backgrounds, such as a Catholic mother and a Jewish father, and the number of Americans raised in interfaith homes appears to be growing.
Joining us now to talk more about the report is Gregory A. Smith, Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. Gregory, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a huge report, Greg, tapping into the religious landscape of the United States. Let's talk about these interfaith households. Spell out some of the numbers that you found as you started to look into this.
Yeah, well, you cited, I think, one of the most important ones. About 1 in 5 American adults say they come from a religiously mixed background. That includes about 1 in 10 people who say that their parents both had a religion, but religions that were different from each other. Importantly, however, there's another big group, another 1 in 10 American adults, who say one of their parents belonged to a religion, one of their parents was Catholic or Protestant as Jewish, and the other had no religion at all. They were atheist, agnostic, or just nothing in particular when it came to their own particular religious identity.
Now, 1 in 5, one way to look at it is that, well, that means 4 in 5 came from a family with parents with the same religious background, or I guess a single parent family, just one. But this is really different. This is really a rise compared to the past, isn't it, of people in interfaith households?
Well, it certainly looks that way, and you're right to point out that if 1 in 5 adults come from a mixed background, that means that 4 in 5 come from a single kind of religious background. We shouldn't lose sight of that. However, the data do show that millennials, the youngest adults that we were able to talk to, are much more likely to come from a religiously mixed background than are their older counterparts. More than a quarter of millennial adults say they come from a mixed background, compared with only about 1 in 5 Generation Xers and baby boomers, and fewer still among Americans from older generations. So it does look like mixed religious backgrounds may be on the rise in the United States.
And let's define our terms a little bit. So what are we defining as a group? Because if we started, say, breaking down within Protestant, is that a Baptist marrying a Methodist? You didn't go that fine with the distinctions in this broader report.
That's right. You have to make a lot of judgment calls anytime you're doing this kind of analysis. In this particular report, we treat Protestantism as a single religion, and we recognize and appreciate that you might make that other researchers might make a different decision on that. It can be really difficult, though, when you start to analyze intra-Protestant marriages in terms of determining the extent to which that might include a real mixture, and to what extent it might include people who belong to different denominations but really hold a lot of the same beliefs. We thought the most conservative approach, so to speak, was to treat Protestantism as a single category in this analysis.
Right. So if anything, if you decided to break it down more, we would see potentially more interfaith households if we broaden the definition that way. So this is a pretty striking increase, even if we're not doing that.
That's exactly right. If you were to treat Baptists and Methodists and Lutherans as separate religions, then the numbers would only go up. Instead of 1 in 5 Americans, you might see 1 in 4, 1 in 3. We haven't done the analysis to know for sure, but the numbers could only go up from here.
Talking to Greg Smith from Pew Research Center. They've done a big study on the religious landscape in the United States. These are things they also track over time. Right now we're talking about a rise in interfaith households, people from different religious backgrounds, or one parent with a religion, one without. Interested in hearing from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Are we describing the household that you grew up in? We'd love to hear how that worked out. Or is this the household you're raising kids in? Again, 800-642-1234. And Greg, let's talk about the kids who grew up in these families. What are we learning in this report about whose religion they pick up, if anyone's?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things we can point to. Number one is that among people who were raised in a mixed religious background, they really could go any number of different directions when they reach adulthood. Some people from mixed religious backgrounds follow and wind up adopting their mother's religion for themselves. Others adopt their father's religion for themselves. Still others opt for neither one and sort of chart their own proverbial spiritual course, if you will. Now, one thing, though, is clear. There is one conclusion you could take away from these data. If you were a parent and you want to maximize the chances of passing on your own faith, or no faith for that matter, you want to maximize the chances of passing that on to your children, then the key really seems to be that you want to make sure that they're raised only within that faith and not in another. If you're a Catholic and you want to make sure that your kids or maximize the chances that your kids will grow up to be Catholic, then it's important that their other parent also be Catholic. If you're Protestant and you want your children to grow up to be Protestants, then it's important that their other parent also be Protestant. Once you introduce another element into the equation, then everything is kind of up for grabs.
Yeah, but it's not a slam dunk even within that, Catholic parent family. It's not a guarantee that the kids will grow up choosing to stay with Catholicism, is it? I mean, the percentage is higher, but not 100% or close to that.
Absolutely not. You're absolutely right about that. There really are no guarantees in American religion. There's a lot of churn. There's a lot of changing. There's a lot of switching that goes on within American religion. But we can see in the data that among people raised exclusively in Catholicism by two Catholic parents or by a single person who was Catholic, they have about a 6 in 10 chance of identifying as Catholics as adults. The same thing is true for people who are raised without any religion. If both of their parents are religiously unaffiliated, that is to say they have no particular religious identity, then their kids have about a 6 in 10 chance of also being religiously unaffiliated when they reach adulthood. If you introduce another kind of religious influence into that dynamic, the numbers go down pretty precipitously from there.
Now, getting back to this rise from generation to generation of interfaith marriages, again, not the norm, not the majority, but a growing number. And we hear in other sociological research about the big sort. We're more and more only encountering, working with, dealing with people like ourselves in terms of class, political opinions, things like that. This marriage data suggests we're maybe unsorting a little bit. We're more prone to interact and even marry people who aren't from our faith or lack of faith background.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Religious intermarriage is not uncommon at all. We know that about a quarter of all married people today are married to a spouse from a religion that's different than their own. And part of what's driving that trend is that we've seen remarkable growth over the last couple of decades, really, in the share of American adults who say they have no religion, who identify themselves as atheist or agnostic or as just nothing in particular in terms of their religious identity. That group is growing very rapidly. And as a result, you have an increase. It looks like you have an increase in the number of marriages that match a Christian in particular, a Protestant or a Catholic, with someone who has no religion. And that kind of mixing is very common.
That's interesting. I mean, that seems like it might be a tough call. Did your research at all ask people how they prioritize one parent or the other's religious tradition, or did you not dig to that level of specifics?
We did. We asked people to look back on their own childhood, and we asked them, you know, which of your parents was more responsible for your own religious instruction? And lots of people say that their parents shared in their religious upbringing equally. But among those who say one or another of their parents was more responsible for their religious upbringing, people by and large name their mothers. Mothers play a bigger role, play the lead role more often than not in the religious instruction of their children. And perhaps as a consequence, among people who come from a religiously mixed background, those folks are much more likely to identify with their mother's religion when they reach adulthood than they are to identify with their father's faith. Among people raised by two biological parents who had different religions, half now identify with their mother's religion. Only about a quarter identify with their father's religion, and the remaining quarter identify with something completely different.
We're talking to Greg Smith, Associate Director of Research at Pew Research Center. His recent reports show that 1 in 5 Americans grew up in interfaith households, and that number is rising. The younger the generation, the more likely you are to be in a mixed faith or mixed faith and non-faith household.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Did you grow up in a household where multiple faiths were represented? How did you navigate different traditions? Are you marrying someone from outside your religion? And how did you teach your children about religion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back with a conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Gregory A. Smith, Associate Director of Research at Pew Research Center. His recent report shows that 1 in 5 Americans grew up in interfaith households.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up in an interfaith household? Parents of different religious, spiritual backgrounds, non-religious backgrounds for that matter. How did it change your outlook? How did it modify your traditions? Did you pursue one of their paths, neither, or a hybrid thereof? And have you yourself married outside of your faith? How do you talk about religion in your household? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We'll start off with Mark in Delavan. Mark, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, I was raised in an Episcopalian household. My father was an Episcopalian priest, but didn't really, you know, push things on me. And when it came time to get confirmed, I actually didn't want to be confirmed in the Episcopalian church. And I didn't understand that when my mom asked me if I wanted to or if I wanted to think about it, that what she probably meant was, did I want to consider some other form of Protestantism? I started looking into Taoism and Buddhism, and now I'm an agnostic. I did get married to a Catholic woman. We're no longer married. And I was agnostic then and just said, you know, yeah, the kids can go to Catholic school. I just want to be able to debrief them when they get home.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting couple of generations there, it sounds like, Greg. A couple things there. Moving away from the tradition, both parents, it sounds like, Episcopalian, both Protestant, in terms of your research, Greg, turning to something completely different. How common, you mentioned the Catholic numbers, I think. How common is that for Protestant couples?
Well, you know, one thing that I was struck by is the switch, the change from being raised in an Episcopal background to exploring different faiths. That is not at all unusual. One thing that is so striking in these data, that's so striking to me every time I look at them, is that there are many, many Americans who switch religion at some point in their lives, who switch religion between childhood and adulthood. If we treat Protestantism as a single religion, then we can see that fully one-third of American adults currently identify with a religion or with no religion that is different than the way in which they were raised. And if we add to that switching between the major Protestant traditions, between evangelicalism and mainline Protestantism and the historically black Protestant tradition, when we add that in, the numbers go up even higher. More than 4 in 10 American adults currently have a religion different than the one in which they were raised. So it is very common for Americans to explore other options and adopt religions for themselves that may be different than those of both of their parents.
Right, and as I understand it, that's a huge trend, the last thing you mentioned, from what we might consider mainstream Protestant traditions that got big in the United States in the 1800s to interdenominational, big interdenominational churches. This is still a big thing, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. If you look at the long-term trends in American religion, then you can see that the Protestant share of the population as a whole has been declining for quite some time. And those declines are concentrated especially within mainline Protestantism. The share of Americans who identify with mainline Protestant denominations now stands at about 15% or so. And that's come down in recent years. By contrast, the share of Americans, the number of Americans who identify with evangelical Protestantism is steady. In fact, the numbers of evangelical Protestants in the United States may even be growing. So these are two parts of Protestantism that really have been and remain on different trajectories.
Thanks for sharing your story. To our caller, we'll go next to Kim in Perry, North Carolina. Kim, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Kim?
Really enjoying the show. Because my family is the blendedest of blended families ever. My grandmother, I was raised part of the year at my grandmother's house. She was a devout Lutheran. And my mother was from the South, and she was a hellfire and brimstone Southern Baptist. Like, you know, sulfur, everything, the whole thing. My stepfather was a devout Catholic. So my brother, who's a year younger than I am, is a Mormon. I myself am a Muslim. I have one sister who's a Catholic and one who's a Buddhist. My older daughter is an evangelical Christian and a missionary, and my younger daughter is an atheist.
Kim, I gotta ask, what is the family meal like when you all get together?
Oh my gosh, we haven't even talked about the multicultural facet. The sister who's Catholic was married to a guy from Laos. But it's actually that my other sister, who became Buddhist, which is, you know, the predominant religion of Laos, and then I married a Turk, And so there's our meals, our get-togethers are fabulous.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for sharing that. Greg, Kim's family, a microcosm of the American religious melting pot, it sounds like.
I think so. I would love to be a fly on the wall for some of those conversations. You know, it's that certainly is a very diverse family background. I'm not sure I can say how common or uncommon that is. I do think, though, it points to one thing, and this gets back to something we touched on earlier, which is to say the conservative estimate that these numbers really are. You know, the way we did this survey is we asked people, who raised you? And then many people were raised by two biological parents, but some were raised by step-parents, others in other arrangements. And we only asked them about the religion of the two people who were most responsible for raising them. We didn't ask them about the religion of their grandparents. We didn't ask them about the religion of their aunts and uncles and cousins. These numbers really are a conservative estimate of the amount of religious mixing and matching that goes on in the United States. And I think the caller's experience kind of points to that.
We're talking about religious mixing and matching with Greg Smith from Pew Research Center. He worked on this huge study of religious life in the United States, talking about interfaith families, children brought up in different generations by people of different faiths or lack of same. Back to our callers now with Kirsten in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just going to introduce another dynamic here. My wife and I are a same-sex married couple, and we argued for about 5 years about what religion we wanted to be together. I'm Lutheran, she's Catholic, and we were both pretty stuck on our religions and not willing to budge, but actually read research, much like this research, that said our best chance in our child having any religion was to make sure we picked the same one. And so one caved, the Catholic caved, and we ended up being Lutheran, and we're raising our daughter Lutheran. But in the end, we did choose a Catholic school for our child to go to, so we each kind of made out in the end.
Kirsten, thank you so much. A fascinating story about the negotiation, Greg, that goes on in an interfaith family. And this is probably a conversation that's been replicated in something like one of five families, as you found in your research.
That's absolutely right. There's no question that that religion is an important part of what it means to be married and an important part of what goes into making a good relationship. Many people, more than 4 in 10 Americans, tell us that having shared religious beliefs is very important to them, that they think it's one of the central ingredients that goes into making for a successful marriage. And I think the caller's experience kind of points to that.
Kirsten, thanks for sharing your story. Time for one more story from a listener, Gina in Illinois. Gina, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I would like to kind of share another dynamic, I guess, is how religion had affected our family. I come from a family of 7 children, and all but 2 of us had received communion. We all were baptized Catholic, but my parents pulled out of the Catholic Church when I was probably at the age of 2 or 3. Since then, we had not practiced any sort of religion unless if a few of us kids would stay at a cousin's, then we would go to the church that they were going to. And it would happen that on my mother's side of the family, they were Jehovah's Witness. So we went from, you know, going to the Catholic Church to sometimes going to a Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall on a Sunday. But that disappeared when my brother had committed suicide. That seemed to kind of throw all of us kids all in different directions.
Wow. Gina, thank you. I'm sorry. We're just about out of time, Gina. But Greg, I wanted to wrap up briefly. We have all these options. People are apparently shopping around for different religions just in 20 seconds or so.
There's no question about it. If you had to characterize religion in America in just a few words, a couple that I would highlight are dynamism and also churn. There's a lot of religious switching, a lot of religious mixing and matching that goes on within American life.
We'll leave it there, Greg. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Gregory A. Smith, Associate Director of Research at Pew Research Center. He joined us to talk about his recent report showing 20% of Americans, at least, grew up in interfaith households. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.